Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, or good night, depending on where you are in the world. Welcome to The Griff Report, live Monday through Friday, 2 p.m. Eastern. I'm your host, The Griff God.
Hotep Jesus. Hotep Jesus. Hotep Jesus.
Hotep, you're a genius. HotepJesus.com.
Oh, this is a real Hotep, brother.
Hotep to the Hotepistanis. Hotep to the chat.
Hotep.
What's happening, y'all? What's happening? Where's my chatters at in the building? I know we got a lot of new chatters in here, the crypto heads. Fair warning to people new to the channel. We are fascists over here. We are crypto fascists. So if you come in and chat, you say anything disrespectful, the ban hammer does come down swiftly. So I don't want to hear you going to Twitter and crying and saying, oh, they banned me in Hotep Jesus channel. That's what we do here. It's very Stalinesque in this section of YouTube. Okay, shout out to from our horse Heather Harnett, Renee Vogel. Shout out Renee Vogel. Renee Vogel put together the artwork for today's debate. He is the real MVP. Appreciate you, bro. Shout out to Robert Jones, Lauren, Justine Ellison, and we're gonna get right into this debate. Today's debate is about securing the blockchain network. What's best, proof of work or proof of stake? And today, as you'll see on your screen here, we have the combatants, Justin Bonds out of Europe, and we have Jagdeep from Syscoin. And these are our combatants. Gentlemen, welcome to the show. Thank you for joining me today. I'm a geek. Everybody knows I'm a geek, so I'm looking to learn a lot from you today. What I'd like to do is go ahead and ask you guys to basically tell us your premise and your argument for why your technology is best, and and start there. Probably, you know, hold it short to 2 minutes. Which one of you guys wants to choose? Jag, heads or tails?
Heads.
Heads? Mm-hmm. All right, I'm going to go to the Coin Flipper app, and I'm going to go ahead and you guys will see this right here, so they know. No funny business. Here we go. You ready? Actually, right here. Boom. You guys see it?
Yep.
Heads it is. Heads it is. Jag's got heads. Jag, do you want to go first, or would you like Justin Bonds to go first?
Justin, go. Sure.
Justin, you're on the clock, man.
All right, let's go. I was hoping you would say to go first. I'm actually curious on what angle you would take, because I think at this stage of development, I see very little lift objectively that's really going for proof of work. So I'll make the argument that actually proof of stake is more decentralized, more economically sound, more secure, and all of this is. And not just because of this, but a lot of this is due to it simply just being more efficient, where a proof of work system uses a lot of arbitrary computation, you know, in order to achieve consensus, where we're able to achieve the same thing with simply just deploying stake in order to achieve consensus. So from that technological perspective, that's far, far more efficient by several orders of magnitude, which I think ultimately in terms of blockchain design has to translate into, you know, no matter what way you cut it, either the system will have lower inflation or have lower fees. It's a better system in my view. And we can get down to the details of why that is. But I think a lot of that would come down also to the cost of to attack the system. If you attack a proof of stake system of an equivalent market capitalization and let's just assume similar attributes, the proof of stake systems are several of orders of magnitude more expensive to attack. So I would argue that means proof of stake systems are more secure and therefore more decentralized because they do in fact have a wider distribution of participants in them, which is what decentralization is. Whereas in proof of work systems, what you often see is due to economies of scale, you know, actually that creates a centralizing effect. So, you know, where you might have realistically maybe only 1,000 participants, significant participants in a proof of work system, proof of stake system, we're talking about potentially hundreds of thousands of participants at scale. So I think at that point, you know, I do really wonder, you know, what argument there is left for proof of work. And I think that's the perfect opportunity for you to take it from there.
Mm-hmm. Did you want to cover history of your in the industry, or do you think that people would already kind of know what your history, where you came from, and like the sort of the linearity around your position in the industry or experience in the industry? I was planning to cover some of that.
Sure. No, and I would love to hear your background on this. I think ultimately it is irrelevant to the arguments if we're taking a strictly rational approach to things. But okay. I think I've been very consistent over the years in terms of, you know, having this position. And this is why I became a Bitcoin critic by 2017. And I've supported Bitcoin Cash. I've supported Ethereum. I've supported a number of different projects over the years. I support Solana today just because they're scaling where Ethereum is not. I'm sorry. I'm confusing arguments here. My apologies. I just recently came fresh off the press from some proof of stake debates, some scaling debates as well. No, actually, in that regard, I don't see how my history is particularly relevant to it. I think I really moved away completely from proof of work, you could say, at least from a blockchain research perspective by 2019, I would say. I had completely abandoned proof of work just because I really view it as being just a way more inefficient and inferior way of doing things, basically.
Interesting. In 2019, I was reinforced proof of work in my mind, so should be a good debate.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, so we have been involved since around the beginnings of Bitcoin as well, and got involved with Syscoin around 2014. We view Bitcoin as a host through four layers: operating system as an EVM, ZK layer as an SDK or a decentralized cost model, which I'll go into why that's a more efficient mechanism, and then an app layer, which is global or even interplanetary coordinated software by removing the relevance of time because of the ZK decentralized cost model.
But hold on, this has no relevance to the proof of work or proof of stake debate, right? You can layer. No,
he's giving it just his bio.
Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah. Okay, sure. Go ahead.
So a little bit of history, and then I'll get into my thesis. In 2014, we started. We researched merge mining with Bitcoin. And that's interesting component of proof of work, is to be able to share mining with the miners to secure external ledgers. In 2015, we researched what you could do more than just store value, SVTs or simple value transfers. We researched virtual machines. We thought we couldn't scale that with BTC. We implemented nationwide digital identity systems. And through all that, we learned that human governance working with these banks, these statewide banks, we learned that human governance will 100% force it become suboptimal due to regulatory capture or corporatism. And we learned where governance should and shouldn't be used. So that was interesting learnings from 2015. 2016, we saw the big block debate. We chose Bitcoin as a court system, not as a transaction processor. And we saw the first sparks of modularity. So I don't know if we're going to cover modularity or not, but we could. In the end, we researched Lightning Networks, found that there were attacks in the LN systems, particularly Flood and Loot, and they're unsolvable. We also found that it ends up making it into a hub and spoke model, and that it can support multiple assets due to the American call option problem. And then in 2017, we created our platform tokens, the UTXO assets. We demoed it to the SEC, got some pretty positive feedback on compliance solutions, regulatory use cases regarding those. And then we started looking at how can we increase the Nakamoto coefficient of the blockchain, which means how many distinct entities are validating your network. In early Ethereum research on the proof of stake side, we were pointing towards covering some subsidy to run full nodes. And so we released Sentry Nodes, which effectively encapsulates proof of stake within proof of work in some ways, without all of the issues of proof of stake. These are increasing the Nakamoto coefficient. We studied how to create finality through that system in a safe way. And that was something called chain locks we did in 2019. That enforced our thought process around proof of work as a dominant algorithm on top of proof of stake, as we solved for selfish mining, which is Bitcoin's major issue. And then 2021, we established a dual chain because, again, I was saying EVM is a critical aspect to flexibility to do smart contracts. And then in 2023, we completed our modular thesis by doing a DA protocol called the Bitcoin DA, or proof of data availability, which allows modular blockchains to scale up, thinking of them as multiple CPUs, multi-CPU instead of multi-core. And now we are thinking in 2024 that the EVM chains are digital smart cities. Bitcoin is a vault city, and we are looking at ways to connecting them together, especially through stuff like merge mining. We are researching light client security. We've got a white paper coming on that, which is a security framework. Because of the fundamental breakthroughs of optimistic bridging like BitVM, we're in a need for academic work to come up with security frameworks around that. So that's some of our work applied to Bitcoin. So our thesis is that we are we're looking at 5-year timeframes now. The way we're playing it out, you know, the last game in town is Microsoft versus Google in the AI arms race. There's a mad situation with China and US. There's a lot of ETH-focused development coming from Bitcoin, coming to Bitcoin from ETH. So we can't really look ahead from 5+ years and how everything's going to play out. We can, you know, create ideologies, but we can't look too far ahead because we don't know what that world will look like. But all we can look for is how do we solve this next 5-10 years in a stable way, without giving up the decentralization and permissionlessness of the systems we create.
Since we're doing introduction, I might as well do a short one as well then.
Okay. Sure.
Like you, I also got started seriously by 2014. And I've been a blockchain researcher. I founded Cyber Capital, which is a investment fund. So as part of that investment fund, I do long-term research in the fundamentals. So that allows me to combine, you know, being a researcher, being a critic, and also being an investor all in one, because I find the technology endlessly fascinating. And it's great to have to put a feather in the scales of history so early on, obviously. And I was involved in a lot of the early block size debates that informs a lot of my views of today. I was a big supporter from Ethereum from the beginning, but when they pivoted away from layer one scaling, then I pivoted away from Ethereum. So in that sense, I've been very consistent in having a more of a monolithic view on things. Nowadays, I'm very focused on sharding being a very good solution to that, and that's something I've been more focused on in terms of a lot of my research. So yeah, I said I would keep it short, and I'll give you a chance to talk about.
Well, since you're an investor, maybe stuff. You know, after this, you guys shake hands and invest in the Syscoin business. Yeah. That's if proof of work wins you over.
I'm a very opinionated investor as well, as you can tell. So
absolutely.
Well, if we're not able to turn the tide there, I would say I'm not doing my job.
Well, no, I mean, some disagreements are respectable. You know, there's a lot of people that support proof of work and that I still respect. You know, I think they're wrong, but I still respect and like a lot of those people. And
as long as there's logic to back all that up.
Yeah, I mean, personally, I think there is some bias there, but you know, bias is a very powerful thing in our lives. I think a lot of our beliefs are driven by things like that.
We should probably start off with your controversial take here on X app. You said proof of work is an outdated technology far eclipsed by proof of stake. Mining is incredibly inefficient compared to staking, making it less secure and less economically sound. Proof of work also centralizes with economies of scale.
Yep, I think that's all true. That's what I summarized. That's a good summary of what I said earlier.
Of what you said earlier. Absolutely. Jag, how do you respond to that?
Well, yeah, I was going into some of that. My thesis is that proof of work is more decentralized and permissionless than proof of stake. And we're not saying proof of stake isn't useful. We actually have components of this in our system. We are actually saying that proof of stake has higher security for honest behavior in the short term. because of the attributable aspects, being able to slash and be able to detect who is wrong, while proof of work has more of the interesting trade-offs where you don't know who is who, and you have you know, sort of black blocks where you have no ability to slash someone other than the attribution of the work, the longest chain rule. But, you know, that being said, proof of work has better black swan prevention, you know, long-term security decentralization permissionless.
Let's break these things down a bit in detail. Because I think there's we're setting up some core assumptions here, and it's really important that we break these down. So did you say that proof of work is more decentralized?
Mm-hmm.
Can you explain? Can we dig into that specifically?
Yeah. So I'm going to make some more claims, and then we could go into each one of those if we want to.
Yeah.
But there's I'll delegate that to a Tim Roughgarden's recent white paper that's proving that thesis. So I'll invite you to read that, and it'll cover more detail.
I mean, I think as part of this debate, you're going to have to make the argument that the thesis makes, if that's what your mm-hmm. arguments are going to rely on, right? I can't.
Mm-hmm. Well, there's a lot of other components to this. I'm also going to make some more claims, and okay. some of them might mm-hmm. seem outlandish to you, and we can go into each one of those.
I'll write them down over here. I'm taking notes.
Okay. So proof of work is more of a commodity monetary stack, and proof of stake is more of an equity monetary stack. Barter instruments, you know, like money, when you go to point of sale, will be developed on top. These are gas instruments. They're monetary stacks, but one is a commodity. One is more like an equity. Proof of work is hard, offers hardness, hard money, or hard monetary stack. And proof of stake is software. It requires liveness for full nodes due to subjectivity. Proof of work has governance.
Sorry, that last sentence. That was a mouthful. That something subjectivity. Could you repeat that?
It requires liveness of full nodes. So the network always requires full liveness because of the subjectivity problem with proof of stake. And this is consistent with all proof of stake, regardless.
Can you explain the subjectivity problem?
Well, you need to be able to find a node to build a sync up with if you're off the network for a long period of time. So you require constant checkpointing and a finality as well. If you have finality in your blockchain, you always have to have nodes online. If you're enforcing finality, then you can have a halting problem if finality is not happening.
But hold on. In BTC, proof of work, you also always need nodes online, right?
Mm-hmm. You just need one honest node to propagate. You can shut your node off for 10 years and come back. There's no subjectivity for you to sync up to the network. It's just you just need one honest node in the mesh network to sync up to.
The
longest chain rule is the thing that removes the subjectivity.
The longest chain rule removes subjectivity. I think that's an important claim, wouldn't you say?
Mm-hmm. Well, because proof of work has a cryptographic assumption built in, and that's another part of the thing is proof of work is more cryptographic, while proof of stake is more crypto economic and game theory to secure it, which, you know, that's why some of the people are saying these systems require governance. I would say proof of stake requires governance because of the liveness aspect of it. I have three more points and we can go on.
Okay, there's a lot to unpack here. Yeah, continue.
I know. Yeah. Proof of work, like I was saying, there's my thesis is that it's governance by ownership, especially coming into singularity and AGI. It's going to be when we're on maximally truth-seeking behavior, and really we don't know what the job market or the value creation looks like.
So proof of stake is governance by ownership, right? Because you compared it to equity, right?
No, I'm saying proof of work is governance by ownership, as in you can decide where society should spend. It's not governance as in the protocol governance. I'm talking about societal governance, where you would decide where humans should spend time and value based on, you know, potentially how much how much of that you own. In the AGI, when it comes, it's not going to be dealing with fiat. It's going to be needing some sort of currency in the digital world.
I mean, I'm holding myself from pushing back on any of these claims, but mm-hmm. this one in particular seems very counterintuitive to me, because mm-hmm. you know, comparing power to kind of this societal ownership, I mean, proof of stake brings about a far more equitable participation of consensus, right, compared to a proof-of-work system. In a proof-of-work system, you're just dealing with a few industrialists that basically control the majority of the hash rate, right, versus, you know, thousands of people being able to run nodes from home even if they want to. So, like, this idea, like, stakeholders being able to actually directly contribute in governance versus having this kind of elite ruling class of industrialists. Yeah, that if anything is governance by ownership, it's proof of stake, not proof of work. And you literally earlier compared proof of stake to being an equity, right? Mm-hmm. And that is consistent of having governance by ownership, because that's how equity works as well. Right.
I'm not talking about protocol governance. I'm talking about, you know, deciding where humans should spend their time. It's a different form of governance. It's like how we have governance with through governments today. We think there's a disruption, you know, potentially that would allow people to decide where to spend time based on them actually owning the coins rather than miners or anything like that. Miners are beholden to the owners of the coins. It's not. I'm not talking about protocol governance, where Bitcoin should go based on.
Okay, this seems very, it's becoming very obscure now, right? So wait, how is this governance different? So this is not the governance of the protocol. This is the governance mm-hmm. of what exactly? Sorry.
It's a different. I'm not talking about protocol governance. So I'm talking about I'm drawing the thesis that, you know, in the future when we have AGI, we have singularity. Whenever it comes, it's likely the fiat dollar may not be around anymore. You're going to need a new governance.
This
structure,
seems
a global
all
governance
very
structure.
Like metaphysical and like far out for what mm-hmm. is a comparison of two technologies to achieve consensus. Right?
Okay, let me stick to the proof of stake side, which requires
sure.
human governance.
You said you wanted to make two more points, right? Let's move on to those and we'll loop back.
So yeah, proof of stake, more equity-like because it requires human governance to deal with systemic risks. Okay. Ossification doesn't really solve the problem there. Proof of stake has about 10 times more complex game theory or more attacks than proof of work because of the larger code base and more possible attack vectors.
I think that's the only one I can probably agree with you with on so far is
sure,
proof
sure.
of stake might come with some more complexity. Yeah,
sure.
Sorry, continue.
Yeah. And then proof of work has a more fair distribution that's bootstrapped with energy, while proof of stake is bootstrapped with fiat or something else other than...
I've got some great counter example to that one, but I'll,
sure.
again, loop back later.
So for me, that makes the fiat the base value in the world, you know, at the bottom of Exeter's pyramid rather than proof of stake, which is more of a derivative. So that's my thesis, and we can go into more from there, whichever one you
okay.
want to go into.
Yeah, there's a lot to get into. I'm glad we're having a very productive debate so fast. This is great. Wow. So instead of starting by directly countering these arguments, I want to create clarity. I think I want to just like call in some common sense here a little bit. And I think I'll create an example in order to do that. And then we'll loop back and I'll cover these points of yours that we've written down. So I want us to compare a proof of work system and a proof of stake system. Okay. And let's do this together. Let's go over these steps and let's see how many steps we can agree on together. And I've done some calculations on this in the past using historical figures, but just for the sake of example, let's just say it's $100 billion proof of stake network and $100 billion proof of work network, right?
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to start with the cost to attack idea. Mm-hmm. And I noticed there's actually, you did not claim that. So let me be clear on this. Do you think proof of work is more secure or do you think proof of stake is more secure?
I think proof of stake has attribution, which makes it in the short term harder to attack. So it's actually more costly to attack proof of stake
okay.
in the short term than it is proof of work.
Yeah, that's interesting. So actually, I realize I wrote down all these points, but you did not claim that proof of stake is less secure. So
I actually said that in my second point.
Yeah. Okay. So yeah, that's good that you concede on that point then. So that we can enshrine that proof of stake is more secure, because now we're going to be talking about trade-offs, right?
Mm-hmm. So I'm talking about in the short term, honest behavior, proof of stake, definitely more secure.
And we'll get into the long term as well. I'd like to get into that too. But let me just explain why I think at least proof of stake is more secure. So we have the $200 billion networks, right? If you wanted to attack the proof of work network, right, using kind of historical figures and kind of average inflation numbers, you could say it would cost $2 billion to attack that network, to gain a 51% attack, let's say. And if you want to take it even further, right, and I'm really being gracious here, let's say, I'm saying, okay, well, they can switch the proof of work algorithm, right, in order to mitigate the attacks. But you can only do that once, because if you switch to GPUs or you know, CPUs, whatever, then you can't switch again to go back to CPU, GPUs. And then a very, very well-funded attacker would actually have ASICs ready for the first round of the attack, and then possibly even the GPUs and CPUs ready, or at least the ability to rent enough to actually carry out such an attack. So then we would say $4 to $5 billion to actually attack that system. Do you agree? More hypothetical?
It's more about how they, you know, in the face of an honest minority or honest majority takeover, how do they deal with those situations and how do they resolve? Are they able to resolve without governance? If they need governance, if they need to fork, then that's one thing. If they can resolve themselves, what are the ramifications? You know, is it a dead network if they're in that situation? For example, on Ethereum, you know, which is the dominant proof of stake right now, one third of the validators, you know, are needed to sign on a fork. But if you're less than one third, you get slashed, right? Mm-hmm. So if anything over one third, you can sign on a fork. Less than one third, 30% are only needed to create large reorganizations in the blockchain and delay the finality, right? This is, there's a paper on this from Harvard University, actually. So if you're able to get 30% of the network, you can selfishly mine Ethereum for $5, you know.
But let's continue with that. And I actually agree in Ethereum's case, there are proof of stake systems where there's a 50% threshold, but most of them have the one third threshold. And it's for the exact reasons that you're correctly pointing out. But I think even then, even if we assumed a one third stake, right, then if we look at how much would it cost to attack that $100 billion network, if we say assume 50% of it is staked, right? So that means they would need more than $25 billion to attack the network, and then one third of and have to reduce that by one third. So let's say it would cost about $20 billion or so to attack the network. So that's fourfold more secure from a purely economic perspective, right? This is the cost to attack, right? So, okay, well, since you already agree with me on this point, let's move on to the next one.
Yeah, so in the short term, it's going to definitely cost you a lot more. It's what do you do when you have that, you're in that situation, and how will the system react, and how will the market participants react?
In a proof of work system, it's game over, right? It's over. I mean, that's it. If you ever committed enough attacker, I mean, at a certain point the attack ends, but then like a lot of the reputation of the blockchain has been destroyed. A lot of people have moved on. It's like people understand the network's insecure, you know?
Yeah, there's a confidence metric there, but it's able to move on without having human governance. Whereas the assumption is in proof of stake, there's always going to be some social slashing or some social governance.
I mean, not necessarily. In my example, I'm not including any form of slashing. I mean, that would make the arguments more complex. At least in this, I'm just saying purely without slashing, you have a system here that is, I mean, slashing provides a potential way out of the doom scenario, right? But it's a pretty ugly one.
Oh, slashing is required for proof of stake. If you don't have slashing, your system has the nothing at stake problem.
I disagree with that. I mean, how would you explain a whole bunch of proof of stake systems today that don't have slashing and they work?
I'm not sure if they're used at any sort of scale and if they've experienced any attacks, then I'm sure it's a lot easier to attack.
Some of them have, but like most proof of stake systems don't have slashing and they function just fine, even under attacks in some cases. As a matter of fact, Solana doesn't have slashing. And that has been under a lot of pressure.
Yeah, I know it's always halting as well, but I think
that's not because of the lack of slashing per se. It's other reasons.
Yeah, from what I understand is if you don't have slashing and you have the weak subjectivity solution because you have slashing, and if you don't do slashing, you have other risks.
I'm familiar with the argument, but I would say here reality disproves the theory.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay, well, either way, you're saying slashing doesn't matter. And what I'm saying is...
slashing is when you take the stake and you literally mm-hmm. destroy it. So if people misbehave within mm-hmm. the... consensus system, then you can actually destroy their stake that they're staking. It's a pretty radical thing to do, but it's also very powerful from a game theoretical perspective. Right. I like it, but for the sake of argument, I'm choosing not to bring that into the equation.
Yeah, there's different ways to slash. I guess if you're creating finality, we are sort of slashing proof of work in some ways because miners have to throw away their work and start over again, but we're not slashing some sort of collateral or anything like that. So there's different mechanisms to slash to create the security. Okay.
So since we agree on the security aspect, and we haven't really touched on the long-term things just yet, but I thought maybe it'd be interesting to talk about the decentralization aspect as well, because I also think that proof of stake, if let's continue with this example, the two systems with, say, equivalent levels of inflation and activity, et cetera. You know, I would expect the proof of stake system to have a what I would call a greater distribution of power. So there's more individual participants involved in the system because proof of stake doesn't have proof of stake doesn't have economies of scale. Right. And therefore, you can have more individual participants and, you know, more everyday people can have a say in governance. And it's not just up to a small group of industrialists that are literally running, you know, mining equipment that you can see from space. I mean, that's not I mean, compared to someone running a Raspberry Pi out of their basement, I would argue the Raspberry Pi in someone's basement is the more decentralized system.
So yeah, like, I mean, running the full node is a little bit different than dealing with. If you're running the full node, you're creating.
I mean, the argument here is you can run the validator that's participating mm-hmm. in consensus, right? I'm using mm-hmm. shorthand a bit, but you can run a validator node in your basement, quote unquote, right? So like mm-hmm. that's like so like it seems to me just on the obvious surface of it, the thing that requires warehouses full of equipment where you need to make special deals with governments, like that thing is clearly more centralized, clearly to me. Like what's the counter argument to that?
Well, if every new miner, actually, even though you have economies of scale, you actually are getting a more efficient for every new participant, right? It's actually distributing every time a new miner is joining. The distribution of miners is going to keep growing, even though you have the pool centralizing. The miners actually themselves are becoming decentralized. Okay. Whereas
I agree, in
proof of stake, it's the opposite. You own stake and you're going to.
Yeah, that's where I disagree. That's where I disagree. Because
Justin, do me a favor. Allow him to just finish his statement before you cut.
Sure. Sorry.
Yeah, no, you can go on.
Yeah, no, that's where I, disagree, actually. And I would agree with you that historically, proof of work has, quote unquote, become more decentralized, right? Because as the market cap increases, there's more competition and more people join, right? Mm-hmm. However, I would argue the same is also true for proof of stake. And historically, this is accurate. Like if you look at projects that have been long-term proof of stake projects, over time, historically, the supply has become more distributed, not less. And it makes sense, right? The founders sell, the VCs sell, then like it gets into more people's hands as it grows in adoption, it becomes more distributed, not less. But on the face of it, if you look at it today, the system that's at $100 billion market cap and the system that has $100 billion market cap over here, the proof of stake system is far more decentralized because it has far more individual participants. Right, that's how we measure decentralization. Well, that's at least one of the important ways to measure decentralization. We could mm-hmm. dive into that more. That's a whole Pandora's box. Mm-hmm. Go ahead.
Yeah, no, it basically, you know, there's different metrics for decentralization, permissionlessness. In Ethereum, you have to have your keys set up. And so there's a metric, obviously, that makes proof of work more decentralized because you don't actually know who the counterparties are. The other thing is obviously if you have proof of work.
But hold on, you're jumping arguments now. I was specifically referring that in Ethereum today, right? Today, even though it's a smaller network than Bitcoin in terms of market capitalization, at least, there's more individual participants in something like Ethereum than Bitcoin, right? And it's a small, like, how do you explain that?
Well, most of the staking pools are pretty centralized. So if something happens there, a lot of honest money is going
to
be lost.
Didn't we just agree not to count pools?
Well, I'm saying if the, you know, basically you can have people lose money even though an attack happens and they have nothing to do with it. The Bitcoin, that's not something that's possible in the protocol, right?
I mean, that seems very specific to Ethereum, the current situation right now.
But I'm just saying all proof of stakes end up the same way. They all end up having that same situation because the econ.
Okay.
Every new participant joining proof of stake is going to retain.
That's not true. No. The reason why that's the case in Ethereum, there's this very specific reason for that. Because in Ethereum, they never built a native delegation. So like most other blockchains, most modern blockchains have delegation built in. So there's no need for a Lido or a Rocket Pool or anything like that. That's what's creating the centralization in Ethereum. It's actually a limitation of how it was designed and how it was created. You look at other blockchains, and I'm actually not a big fan of Cardano, but Cardano is actually a really good example of it because it has a very wide distribution of participants, and because pools are natively built in, it has one of the highest Nakamoto coefficients, which I think is a flawed metric, but still it tells us something, you know, in the entire blockchain space. So no, and it's one of the oldest proof of stake blockchains around. So, you know, saying that, oh no, proof of stake systems just naturally tend towards this type of centralization, I think is clearly false.
Well, I mean, if you think it makes intuitive sense, if you think about it, because there's no bootstrapping or, you know, in the energy concept, it's the bottom of the pyramid of value. It's coming from the environment. So you have nothing to bootstrap it but energy, where proof of stake, it's created from fiat. So situations where
you're jumping in the argument again. Right?
But you're assuming that people are going to sell and distribute in a proof of stake system when they start with a capital or start with a pre-mine. What if that's not the case? And
you're jumping arguments again, right? Like I was specifically referring that you have more individual participants in a proof of stake. That's one measure of decentralization, right?
Are you talking about staking nodes?
Yeah, in terms of people that participate in consensus, in terms of individual parties, let's say, that participate in consensus. I would say that a proof of stake system has a far wider and a far diverse and far greater and far more egalitarian way of participation, which leads to more individual participants compared to proof of work. Which is dominated by massive mining companies, right? That is traded on the stock market.
Yeah, it could be traded on the stock market, but that doesn't stop it from having any less decentralization or permissionless.
No, yeah, but then we have to count
being distributed any differently.
But then we have to count all of that mining power as a single entity, right? If we're measuring decentralization.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
But what happens when those systems are attacked? How does that distribution help in proof of stake?
Let me even be more direct. I don't know what the exact numbers on it. Maybe you can correct me on it. But what, 10 entities at most probably could 51% Bitcoin? I mean, Bitmain, Bitfury, just some of the big ones, right?
I mean,
compared to, it would take thousands of entities to attack something like a well-functioning proof-of-stake system, like Cardano. Mm-hmm. I can't believe I'm saying that right now, but it's useful for the argument. Cardano folks will love it.
Yeah, let's, you know, that's one of the claims of the selfish mining papers that are out there is actually you don't even need 51%. You could do this with as low as 32.9%. Professor Aviv Zohar said. So it's actually more profitable to censor and do selfish mining, and it's more profitable at the same time. It's something that the miners simply don't do, especially the pools, because they would have the social, you know, aspect of miners moving on.
I mean, you could argue, right, that these 10 entities are more decentralized than these 10,000 entities controlling consensus. Is that and for other reasons, right? Is that the argument you're making?
The equilibrium around attacking the proof of work is net positive. You know, there is no net negative, because if these mining pools do decide to turn around the network, the miners have the decision, you know, click of a button to switch over. When they do switch over, then the mining pool loses the ability to,
okay,
to launch those attacks.
I'm not talking about pools. I'm talking about individual entities, right? If you, I'm arguing that, say, I have to double check the numbers, but 10 companies probably control 51% of the hash power, right?
I don't think so. I think the age, like F2 pool, all nodes, F2 pool, Ant pool, and Via control over 60%. And
I mean,
those
two
are
pools. I mean, two pools control over 50% in Bitcoin, right?
So those are pools, and the entity foundry is mostly doing a large operation in the States.
I'll say it's 20. Okay, let's just say it's 20. But that's still a very big difference to say 10,000.
Mm-hmm. Right? It's really hard to have that quantifiable number, because the mining pools, we don't have any information on how many people are running inside there, how many separate entities are inside of that.
I'm taking a look at the chat now.
But even so, what is the game theory around that? Why would they continually 51% attack, and what profit are they hoping to achieve when all they can do is censor transactions? You know, there is no complex games like MEV attacks in the same way as things on proof of stake chains.
I mean, you're obviously far more familiar with. I used to look at these chats all the time. They're less interest of me now. Do you know Foundry USA? Is that a public pool or that's private, isn't it?
It's a company and a sort of a pool at the same time.
Yeah, okay.
So most of the US market is on that side.
Oh, so there's multiple companies that are on that. Yeah, I mean, someone that's more familiar with the mining industry could probably quote the numbers off the top of their head. But I mean, what do you think the number is to reach 51%? I mean, 20 seems reasonable. I think it's likely 10, but 20 seems fine. I mean, what do you think the number is?
Not
just
sure.
Off the top of their head.
It's separate entities. On the east, it's thousands. It's potentially tens of thousands. But on the west, probably hundreds, because of the concentration of what energy is being used. And that's sort of controlled. So that's growing over time. And it started when China banned Bitcoin, it kind of moved over to the West.
Can you at least agree that having consensus predominantly, because this is how the economics of proof of work, predominantly, determined by large industrialist level players, because economies of scale are at work here, right? Means that you have an outcome where you have less total participants in consensus. You can argue that's still more decentralized. That's fine. But, I mean, for the sake of this argument, I mean, I think you do need to make that call here, right?
It depends on how many, like, if you're incentivizing the full nodes to run and you have a fairly light system where anyone can run those, you know, you don't need a supercomputer, then for sure that network can have more full nodes running and therefore participating in the consensus.
Right. And that's inherently due to the differences in proof of stake and proof of work, because proof of stake is more, let's say, quote unquote, egalitarian in terms of who they allow to participate. The size of the nodes, that's, I think, irrelevant. That's, you could say that for both proof of work and proof of stake, right? That's just,
yeah, that's network decisioning.
That's separate.
The algorithms are both, you know, what they're used for is civil protection. So that's what you're using them for,
yes,
to solve the BFD problem.
Well,
so,
and to create it's civil protection and creating consensus. And I would even go a step further, decision making. That's maybe a step beyond the scope of this this debate.
So just proof of stake has obviously some benefits. You have a better latency. You have the ability to do finality a lot better. You have guarantees, use less energy, and then you can recover from 51%.
Okay, but in my example, we have a proof of work system here with, say, 50. I'm just going to say 50. Okay, 50 entities effectively are control 51% because these are industrial size players, right? And over here you have a system with, say, 1,000. I'm being conservative. Small amount. That's a very small amount for $100 billion network. I think Ethereum's in the tens of thousands, but say 1,000 stakers, right? But we can identify through chain analysis. Or let's
but
just say
what is the attack? Like, what are you saying the attack
well,
is?
No, because we're measuring decentralization, right? And there's multiple ways to measure decentralization, and this is one metric. right? And in this one metric, we're saying, I'm asking the question, how many individual participants are there in this system? What's the distribution of power? You know, how many people need to agree in order to attack this network? That's one way to determine the decentralization of the system, right?
There's another one way. The other way is also to determine, you know, how permissionless it is as well, right?
Sure, but I think in this example, because we have the two networks that we're using in the example, let's assume they're both permissionless networks. Mm-hmm. Seems reasonable to me, right? So then
the problem in proof of stake is you have the ability to know, you know, which actors are actually participating.
And, you know, all these counter arguments is fine. I just need you to concede on it that you're saying that you don't need to concede. You can bite the bullet on this, right? But,
sure.
But the implication is that these 50 entities that are able to reach 51% is more decentralized than these 1,000 entities being able to reach 31%. That's the argument you're making. Is that correct?
No, obviously.
Proof of stake, proof of work.
You're saying, okay, let's use an example. You're saying something like Ethereum has more full nodes running than something like Bitcoin?
That's not a smart argument. I think we both know that.
Okay, let's use a light proof of stake blockchain that maybe has been around for a while. Is there any that you can think of?
Cardano is the example I used. So let's
okay,
go.
Okay, so let's say like, do we have data?
I studied it recently, so.
Cardano full nodes. It's a monolithic blockchain, so quite a big state, right? But it's
it's monolithic currently, but it's very little usage, so the state is tiny.
Okay, but so there's no real fee market, so it's but there you would argue that there's more Cardano full nodes running than there would be on something like Bitcoin, even though there's a difference on a
proof of work system of an equivalent size. No, and not full nodes. I'm making that argument. I'm saying individual, say, entities that control those validators and hashing power, if I'm being very exact with my language here.
Okay, so in Cardano, the validators, there's more. There would be something where there'd be more validators running and checking the consensus compared. And those are the ones that could control the ability to, you know, create a fault, some sort of fault, right?
And have the ability to attack as well, obviously. And it's one way. Look, and it's fine if you say, yeah, I think because of the inherent qualities of proof of work, these 50 entities are still more decentralized than these 1,000 entities. That's a fine argument to make, but you do need to bite the bullet on that one. And hopefully I can find some things to concede on because I'm
familiar with that. I guess you have to go a little deeper and say, okay, if the attack was to happen, the decentralization aspect comes into play. Like how does it deal with the attack? Because it's not enough to say you could attack. You have to say, okay, what is the actual ramifications of that, right? What happens after the 51% attack and what is the ability for the network to recover from it? And Cardano, how does it recover from an attack if it was to happen, even if it costs more? How does it deal with it?
Looks like we had a bit of interruption there on Justin's side. Chat, this is just point number one, okay? We got a lot more to get into. Goal today is $50. Super chat, ask your questions. You guys probably won't have access to these technical guys anywhere else. So if you got questions, drop them in the super chats. Welcome back, Justin. You good now?
Yeah, no, I think the CA is spying on me again, just playing a random video on my phone. How about that? During my podcast. I didn't even touch it. Just started playing.
That's crazy.
They don't want us exposing the truth of proof of stake, proof of work, Hotep. That's what it is. Yeah. I want to believe.
But no, Jack, I think you're in the middle of a point.
Yeah.
How would it deal with the attack if the attack was to happen? And how would it require intervention or could the system resolve itself up to some point? You know, what does that threshold look like? You know, how long, does the system have to fix itself before some inactivity leak or something like that renders it useless or requires some social behavior to come in and interject?
Yeah, and I think that's a separate question to the point I've been trying to make, and I think
but that's part of the decentralization dilemma here, right? Because if you don't deal with that, then you're just saying, okay, one is easy to attack, and therefore it's more decentralized or less decentralized, and that's not a fair sort of. I already told you it's easier to attack proof of work than it is to proof of stake. But how do they deal with it?
I think that's a fair argument. Actually, I really do think that's a fair argument. I suppose my position on this, I just think once the blockchain can come under attack like that, I kind of feel like it's already game over.
Let me break down the selfish mining argument, because in the white papers, there is maybe it'll give you some more ammo here.
I'm familiar with selfish mining. I'm a big fan of Immon's work in particular, actually, on this.
So in Immon, he proved under 40% in the second version of the white paper, but the counters to that is Bitcoin. Generally, the argument is if you can detect the attack. So if you're in a proof of stake or proof of work, whatever network you're in, if you can detect the attack, you can react to it. So in the job of a selfish miner is to make it so that it's not detectable. And that's a hard thing to do. Now, Immon tries to claim that there's ways to do that. Aviv Zahar said with 32.9%, you could effectively go and create a detectable attack. When you have detection, then the market sells off because you have the system sort of halts and the confidence goes down. Now, that's ammo, right? Because if the market sells off far enough, what is the point at which it cannot recover? What is the point at which miners drop off? What is the point at which you can continue that 51% attack indefinitely? Now, what is the goal?
Hold on. A selfish miner attack is not exactly a 51% attack, right?
They don't have to. It's not 51%, but the goal is to maximize revenue and likely have the ability to censor transactions, which is the same goal as a 51% attacker in proof of work, right? Because
but even with a selfish miner attack, you wouldn't be able to censor, because I mean, sure, you'd get a row of blocks, right? And you wouldn't include any transactions in your own, right?
You have to 51% to effectively continuously censor, but the goal of the selfish miner is to maximize revenue. Some of that is to focus on when the difficulty adjustments happen, then you
this has already happened on BTC, right? I mean, we've seen this happening. I mean, I've seen it happening in the early days. I'm not sure if it's happening now because I'm not watching the chain as closely.
But, not as much, yeah.
Yeah, I mean,
it's more profitable for you to selfishly mine today. Like if you wanted to, a pool will make more money doing it.
I don't really see it as a problem. Ooh, I discovered, I've been researching Sui recently, and I discovered they actually slash validators that do empty blocks or don't include enough transactions. I thought that was amazing. I just wanted to throw that out there.
And the problem is you can fill that with fake transactions and your own transactions. There's no way to solve that. I mean, you have the permissionless aspect.
You still have to pay the fee though on those. Oh, but those fees would go to yourself. No, but another validator could pick up the transactions.
There's no way to really solve that problem. Like
unless have like a send directly to leader system like you do in Solana, then that would be a problem. Right?
Yeah, like a PBS system, you might be able to have a bounty there. And again, social slashing, right? You're going to need to
thought it was fascinating, but we're getting off topic here.
So anyways, like that whole thing, proof of work is easier to attack up front. It's proof of work is a little bit less complex. There's less attack vectors, less trust assumptions. But it is, in my mind, easier to attack up front. But it deals with the problem in a little bit different way than proof of stake. We actually employ both strategies. But in Bitcoin in itself, the stability and simplicity of it makes it more ideal for what its job is intended to be, you know, as the stable value of the world. You know, and if we say, look, this is Solana's proof of stake that would make it the ideal store of value, that's a different story. So I guess when you go into proof of work versus proof of stake, you start to have to associate it with some sort of network to see how it would react in these situations, how the market participants would really think about it in context of some attacks.
But again, you're making an argument, which basically comes down to once the network comes under attack, so once the security of the system basically fails, then proof of work deals with that problem better. I might be able to agree with you on that, actually, because it's slashing is very ugly, but also like having a dysfunctional network for several months is also very ugly.
In Solana, how does it deal with it? Because there's no slashing. They just the validators basically just decide some sort of
fork. But then it's just game over, right? Like if the majority of your stake wants the network to die, it's game over. I mean
then it's just a database, right? Like that's why you're having these faults. But some of those faults are not, those can be fixed. Like
I mean a lot of the problems that Solana is having right now can be fixed in my view.
But if there is no fork choice rule where you have the ability to go back.
But hold on, let's go back to that. Because basically this is the argument. If it gets attacked, proof of stake, proof of work deals with it better. I might even be able to agree with it. I haven't given it that much thought, actually.
So yeah, no,
But my counter argument is, and I'll let you respond. My counter argument to this is, I think if a network can come under attack, so like censorship, double spends, if that happens, I think the network has already failed. Mm-hmm. Like, I really do think that. Like, at that point, I'm not really that interested in how it deals with that at a later stage. Mm-hmm. I think we need to grow these systems so large that nobody can attack it. And it happens to be that proof of stake increases the threshold to attack with the same amount of value. It's more efficient.
You can never have a situation where you can't have an attack. Like, that's solving the trilemma that's not solvable, right? So you always will have a situation where an attack can happen. Like, imagine we have AGI tomorrow, the bots are infiltrating the cloud, half the internet goes down.
And sure, there could also be an alien invasion and they have supercomputers and they crack all of our cryptography. But I mean, we're not going to plan for that, you know?
That's why I'm saying we're planning for 5 years. Like, in our view, we're planning for 5 years. In the next 5 years, we see proof of work as a more secure system due to simplicity. Proof of stake hasn't even ossified. If you're ossifying, how are you going to, you know, trust billions or trillions of dollars on these systems when they keep updating and there's social risks on that? And we've seen anything with social behavior of humans, it ends up being centralized or ends up being controlled in some way.
We're jumping arguments again because now you're talking about ossification. But yeah, okay.
Yeah, I'm just saying, like, proof of work is already there and it's working. How it deals with the attack is a little bit more
all right. Safer. But you concede, right, that proof of stake is more secure.
Right? And saying in short-term honest behavior.
Can I hop in right here?
Yeah.
Sure.
I think we've hit an impasse with this part of the conversation. We should probably move to the next point.
Sure.
What is the next point you wanted to cover, Justin?
Let's talk about some more points. I think maybe responding. I'm not sure if that puts us back in a circle. Stop us if we do that.
No, go ahead.
But yeah. So some of the notes that you put down here. BTC is a commodity. Proof of stake is an equity. I think in my view, the ideal cryptocurrency is both a commodity and an equity. And I think proof of stake systems really achieve that better. And look, I want to avoid doing. Because I think some of the statements you made, like proof of stake is hard, proof of stake is soft. Let's avoid such rhetoric because it doesn't mean anything.
Well, I can contextualize it if you need to.
All right, let's do that.
Okay, so we have John Exter's pyramid of value. You understand what that is?
You're gonna have to expand on that a little
bit. Okay, so John Exter created something called the pyramid of value. It's assessing assets through the lens of counterparty risk. So that, you know, it's almost like an inverted pyramid where at the base, it's very, very stable, secure things like gold, oil, even phosphorus in times when you have scary events. And then at the top, you have credit default swaps and MBSs and real estate and bonds and stocks. Those are derivatives, right? When you have the pyramid of value, cash is sort of near the bottom as well. You know, cash is king. 1987 was coined after Black Monday. So when you have this pyramid of value at the base, those are your secure systems that people delegate to at times when you're hedging against risk and hedging against some sort of natural disaster or something in the stock market, right? And then the Gresham's law applies to drive out all of the bad money for the good. So usually when you have those situations, everyone flocks to the bottom, to like the gold or the oil or, you know, the black gold or something like the most secure and stable form of value. And so, you know, for me, energy is this, you know, major component that, you know, if you can digitize that and you can harness it, make it tradable and add it, crypto in an economic sense, add it as a transferable utility. And that to me is a base value of, especially if it's very simple. something that could be harnessing the aspect of the base value of the pyramid that could replace gold and replace oil or replace, you know, phosphorus. And phosphorus is really interesting. When you analyze that, there's a really interesting article by Nick Szabo. He called it the two Malthusian scares, and it relates to the Extras pyramid, because when you have Thomas Malthus was a political economist, and he basically.
How about I respond to some of these things first?
Let me finish this, and then I'll circle it all back down, and then you could probably respond better. He said, you know, poverty and famine creates resource contention. And his view is that at some point we're going to run out of resources, and it creates this scare where people flock to the bottom of these value pyramids, right? And he's called it two Malthusian scares. And black gold was coined in 1970 as something that was the base of this, even below cash, because people got scared, like, oh, okay, we need oil to run the world, so oil should be this base value. And in the year 2000s, it was phosphorus actually that was sort of caught this bid, and it hasn't come back down because you cannot synthesize it. You need it to live. You need it to farm. We need this element in the farming industry so we can actually grow crops. And Bitcoin, to me, is this mechanism as you're harnessing energy as the base value. Proof of stake, you know, it does. If you take out Bitcoin and you said Bitcoin doesn't exist and Ethereum launched, it would require fiat. It would require a derivative of some sort of base value. And therefore, it all starts here and ends here. Everything you analyze starts with the fact that you've created a base value of digitizing energy versus some derivative of that. And there's always going to be a tax in the situation. Some sort of game theory exists that makes the derivative susceptible to something that's under it.
Okay. So this is the kind of stuff that I'm very wary of, this type of rhetoric. Because if you say we're digitizing energy and we have energy that we can transfer between each other and proof of work uniquely achieves that, sounds really nice, but I kind of think that's nonsense. If you transfer BTC between each other, you're not transferring energy in the sense of electricity or work. I mean, not any more than you would if you transfer any other form of money. The transfer of money is a transfer of energy, but BTC, the price, the utility, you can burn energy to create it, but you can't destroy it to create energy, right? Mm-hmm. It's a one-way process. It's a proof of waste, right? That's not the same as saying, oh, these units that represent energy. I mean, I read some great sci-fi novels where they had energy units or energy credits that would transfer because they have amazing battery technology, and energy is like the perfect form of money if you think about in this sci-fi futuristic future. But that's not what BTC is at all, right? It's not. It's an incredibly expensive thing that takes up more electricity than small countries to achieve something that normal computers are able to do better at a fraction of the cost.
Yeah, and they have the BFT risks, right? The fault risks. And I'm saying, if you don't go to the base value, you're creating a derivative, and that derivative is going to have more risks. If you're depending on fiat, and if Bitcoin didn't exist and Ethereum depended on something like fiat to bootstrap it, there is tremendous risk there. Now, you can say that over time, it distributes.
I mean, that's true. No, hold on. That's true for a proof of work system as well, right? Like, I mean, who do you
think? You've mined Bitcoin using energy. So you require no USD.
And where do you get the hardware from? How do you pay for the electricity?
It's still directly from energy. You know, whether you invested in it, it's directly a proof that you've used energy to create this digital instrument.
I mean, it's not true. It's not a proof that you've used energy. That's not how Bitcoin works. If I hold a Bitcoin, I say, this is proof that I consume this energy.
So you're mixing concepts. So that's in cooperative game theory. The transfer utility is when you're transferring Bitcoin. See, it has less transferable utility, I agree.
Yeah. So the problem that I have with a lot of this, and with all due respect, but it just seems like so much philosophizing, so many metaphysics, so many like grand ideas. But the bottom line is you're talking about a system that's less decentralized, less secure, less censorship resistant. Like what are we doing here?
It's more decentralized and more permissionless than proof of stake. And the argument I was making is, if you go to the bottom of the value pyramid, there's three main markets in the future. There's going to be energy, computation, and data. And if you're using energy directly, you cannot get any better than that. And I'm trying to make the argument that there's less game theoretical attacks in such a system. It makes it more decentralized. It makes it more permissionless. There's no direct need for USD to buy.
If you say it makes it more decentralized, it makes it more permissionless. You need to justify those arguments, right?
We've gone back and forth on all that and say, like, look, if you're trying to solve for BFT, proof of work.
Okay. My position on that now is, like, if the blockchain comes under attack because the security is that low, I'm just writing off that entire blockchain, whether it's a proof of work blockchain or a proof of stake blockchain. That's like, why are you okay with that scenario?
Well, first of all, the security is not that low, and it keeps increasing as the difficulty keeps going up. And second, it requires constant decisions and constant investment to keep that attack up, because the honest people are going to be adding more hash rate. There's going to be honest people competing with you, and you're going to have to keep your investment growing to attack that system than everyone else. That's a different story.
In that scenario, let's say in 10 years from now, and let's say the security budget really drops a lot, like I've been predicting it will continue to do so. If that happens, or 50 years, whatever, just for the sake of argument, okay? The security budget is like 10 million or something. And then like a committed attacker could attack the network, sensor transactions, even a competitor could fund this, right? And just completely bring down BTC, like it's just unusable for several months and people know the security is being compromised and exchanges require hundreds of confirmations. Because it pushes BTC down. Or imagine a state actor. It doesn't really matter, right? Like you're saying, oh, well, it's important how it deals with this scenario. No, I'm like, no, it's important that we're not in that scenario in the first place. Mm-hmm.
Well, right? you can't stop scenarios from happening. It's how you deal with those scenarios.
Yes, we can. We have to grow these systems as large as we can, grow them as secure as we can, and proof of stake is more efficient at doing that.
Proof of stake has same attack vectors that will end up causing faults, and you have to have social slashing and social correction.
No, you don't need to have social slashing. Right, I'm not saying you do. And I literally told you, in the world right now, we have tons of blockchains that don't have slashing and they work.
But they don't have users.
Yeah, I mean they're not competitive to the market of BTC or ETH. I mean, we have to look at those two and say those are the ones that are competing with each other, right? It's hard to say even Solana. I mean, Solana to a point is probably getting there.
I mean, Solana has more usage than Ethereum and all layer twos combined, right?
Real usage, I'm not sure.
Quote-unquote real usage, if you count like trading bots, which I do count, that's deducting consensus transaction and quote-unquote failed transactions. I'm actually being fairly gracious.
What I meant by social slashing was out of bound slashing. Like I'm talking about community agreeing, let's go take the funds away from this address and start the network again. And that's
you're going back to this, and I don't think it really needs to be part of the debate, really.
So my thesis is proof of stake always requires human social governance.
But you're wrong. Does. I mean, look, I'm actually an advocate of on-chain governance, so that's a different discussion. But I actually do think I think all blockchains require on-chain governance, including proof of work ones, by the way. And I think proof of stake blockchains are inherently better able to achieve that. I'm not sure if I should try to make that argument here. That's another one of the reasons that I support. I might as well make the argument, I suppose. I think proof of work as a governance mechanism is systemically flawed. I think it's due to miners, I think, are weak and don't participate much in governance decision-making at all. And I think the block size debates, I think, showed this. And I think they're very mercantile, and I think they prioritize short to midterm decision making over long term decision making. And I think that's a fatal flaw in the system. I think that's why the block size limit was not increased. But nonetheless, I think even if you think that was a good decision, it's still, that massive governance problem still looms over it. Whereas at least in a proof of stake system, there's a better alignment between the stakeholders and the participants in consensus, and through the use of lock-ins. Through the use of lock-ins, we can actually enforce longer time preferences in terms of decision making. So I actually see that as being also a key important breakthrough in proof of stake.
Yeah, we're talking about different governance now. You're talking about governance related to updating a network and scaling it. I'm talking about dealing with attacks, which is more critical. It's the BFT problem. Like, how do you deal with that? And we already agreed that proof of work potentially has the ability for non-interference mechanisms so you can recover.
Right, but in your scenario, you're talking about a network that there's such an attack. If you have a well-funded attacker and they're serious about this, at the very least, they'll be able to sustain the attack for a few months. At the very least.
Justin, I'm here learning. I'm the student in the room, right? And the one thing my mind keeps saying is, Justin earlier said he wants to deal in reality and not so much hypotheticals and woo-woo stuff. But in this instance, you keep creating a hypothetical, theoretical situation and not dealing in actuals. So to me, that's a bit of a conflict from your side.
That's an interesting dichotomy. I suppose I don't want to make it a BTC versus Ethereum debate, because I don't think that's entirely fair either for Ethereum or BTC, which is why I thought the hypothetical would be more constructive. I can use more literal examples if you think that's.
I'm just trying to follow because, you know, you keep saying things like, well, if BTC gets attacked, right? And in my head, I'm like, well, why isn't it not being attacked?
Because it's got a very high security budget right now. I mean, that's why it's not being attacked.
Yeah.
It would cost a lot of money to attack Bitcoin right now. We're talking about a scenario in the future, or more generally. I mean, this is a debate about proof of work versus proof of stake. So it's not entirely fair to compare the largest network in the world to, say, a smaller proof of stake network, because that's not really speaking to the merits of the design itself. Because the larger a network is, the more secure, the more decentralized it also becomes. So that's why we need to abstract some of this, at least.
Larger adds more honeypots, and actually the fact that most proof of stake networks have not settled down makes institutions much more reluctant to really trust that and put a lot of money on it, right? And now Saylor is saying, you know, those are going to be classified as securities, which would be shitty, but if it does happen, that's proof of work has proven that you don't need to change the protocol. It is what it is.
Hold on. This has nothing to do with proof of work versus proof of stake, right? Like now you're talking about ossification as something that is inherent to proof of work. It's false.
Proof of work. It's happened on proof of work. And proof of stake has not ossified.
And you think that's a good thing?
Well, I think we're looking 5 years at a time. And in the five-year picture, it makes perfect sense. And post 5 years, we may not even be in the same sort of world. And so we can't really predict what that world will look like. All we know is today we need stability, determinism, and something simple. And that's what institutions want.
But I do not. Okay, since we're using an actual example here, BTC is a terrible example for stability, right? It's ossified, as you say, and no one can clearly tell you with a high degree of certainty where the security budget is going to come from in 10 years from now, which will most likely lead to BTC having to increase its inflation rate, because the security budget to keep BTC so the way it is so damn expensive. That's what I'm talking about. It's so damn expensive that BTC won't be secure in a few years, because every halving halves the majority of the security budget. High fees are not being sustained because of how the fee market works. Right. Mm-hmm. So how can you sit here and say, oh, this is the stable thing? When you're talking about a system that is unable to change, that is literally heading into a massive existential disaster in probably less than a decade from now.
You think that the discrepancy between the subsidy and the fees is too high to overcome?
Yes. No, I think if in combination with the 1 megabyte block size limit. Right. With that limit in place, I think Satoshi's original plan for Bitcoin would have worked. I think so. I think could have worked. I should rephrase that. Could have worked. But I think BTC was effectively captured by a small group of individuals who then completely pivoted the vision, the goal, and the fundamental economic design of Bitcoin around 2016-17.
Four megabytes are not enough for it to scale to get enough users.
Yeah, nowhere near enough, no. Which means that transaction fees would have to reach sustained highs like $60, $80 per transaction just to maintain the current level of security. And I think what happens with fee markets is you get these fee spikes, and then fees really spike, and then people leave. Fees go back down, and that cycles continue, and that's not enough to sustain long-term security, right? And I think part of why this is a problem for BTC is because security is incredibly expensive on a proof-of-work system. Proof-of-stake can get you the same amount of security for a lot less money, and that translates either into inflation or fees.
Yeah, and that's why I've analyzed that same sort of behavior, and this is why I'm of the belief that blockchains are court systems, at least the layer ones. The bottom of the stack is a court system, not a transaction processor, which means you don't want dynamic huge blocks because then your security budget is basically zero and you die. But because it's 1 megabyte, you have this resource contention.
Why would the blockchain die if you have
huge blocks and massive fees? Uh-oh, we're moving into a big blocker debate. Uh-oh.
Yeah, I don't really want to get into that. But let me on the security budget, right? Let's go into let's build the case where Bitcoin block space will be valuable, okay? Because when you're talking about something that's if we hypothesize that this is the base value of the base asset. Collateral assets.
That is a completely unjustified assumption to start your argument with. I'll agree with everything you say after that. If I also assume this is the base asset for the world, reserve currency, the whole world adopts it, everyone, this is worth a 10 trillion, like, okay, yeah, sure. I mean, come
okay,
on.
Let's not assume.
Yeah, okay,
that.
Cool.
Let's just build a case where Bitcoin data will be more in demand than it is today, right? So in cooperative economics, transferable utility and non.
So you're assuming demand, which has failed to come for all of these years. But okay, let's go.
And I'll show you how it's happening now. And then non-transferable utility, NTU, is kind of what Bitcoin is today, and it's priced in at $60,000. You know, at NTU. There's no real utility outside of just being your own bank. And
I think most people that are invested in BTC don't really understand what they're invested in. But continue. I didn't mean to cut you off.
So there's no real utility, but what we're seeing is it's a crowded space, and we were the only one when we started 10 years ago. We were the only one to see this sort of thing that, you know, Bitcoin has this NTU problem, and we need to bring in more utility. Taproot, Mast, all this stuff is sort of bringing that in. BitVM was a big boost that's bringing that in. But now we're seeing a crowd from the Ethereum space come around and say, okay, how can we add TU to Bitcoin, add transferable utility? So when we're going to see a lot of utilities start to get unlocked in Bitcoin because of the recent innovations. And those don't even need Bitcoin to change.
You know, I've heard that for all of these years.
It's happening right in front of us. There's hundreds of millions of dollars being funded right around us.
Oh, no, I've seen hundreds of millions of dollars being funded and then those projects going to nothing. That's a cycle that happens every few years in Bitcoin.
So you
still
can
no utility.
Consider them vaporware, but the BitVM proposal is really interesting and it actually adds some validity. And some of our solutions that we're coming up with.
Still relies on permissioned elements though, right?
No, it's trust minimized, actually permissionless. That's the interesting thing. There's no centralized custodian or institution. This is the big breakthrough that we're coming up with. And actually, we're built.
But it's a little bit similar to ordinal theory in that there's some sort of social consensus above the protocol, right?
No, it's different. There's people building on Bitcoin. Like, for example, a project called Citria that's doing a roll-up right on Bitcoin using the Bitcoin data. And the trust assumptions are that Bitcoin won't roll back 51% attack.
Out of all of the research I've done, I've never seen a solution that doesn't either have some sort of external consensus or relies on some sort of federated
system. I'll send you my white paper after this and we can discuss that separately, but there is actual utility without sacrificing trust.
We are going very far off topic here now, right?
Well, we're talking about security budget, right?
All right.
So we're building a case for the DA.
It was a counter to you saying, you know, BTC is the most secure, the most trusted, the most stable thing. And this was just a counter argument to that, right? Mm-hmm. And like now you're making a scenario where you're assuming massive demand and saying all these different technologies are going to come in the future. I mean, that's all fine.
This is all happening. Like, it's not future. It's like happening now.
But it doesn't actually impact our debate, though, does it? About whether proof of work or proof of stake is a superior system.
Well, I think you were saying Bitcoin, the security budget's not, the proof of work mechanism died because the network that's using it is not able to sustain its security budget, right?
Yeah.
So Bitcoin itself, you're saying the fees cannot justify because once the subsidy goes to zero, the network doesn't have enough budget to secure itself, and proof of work is expensive, and therefore it's going to sort of die off, and miners are going to move off. And I'm making the case that the data of the blocks are so precious that the fees are going to rise to a point where
But why is that so precious when today a network that is a fraction of the size of Bitcoin, Ethereum, has higher security today, right? There's been some great papers written about this recently in terms of economic security. So you're saying, well, it's the most secure thing. Well, it's not. It's not. Literally today, it's not the most secure thing. Because proof of stake is just a better technology, which is how a smaller network can be more secure from an economic perspective. Mm-hmm. So like, why is that block space in Bitcoin so precious? There's no immaculate conception here.
It's very simple and it's immutable compared to proof of stake. It doesn't require liveness or doesn't require governance.
Wait, are you saying proof of stake is not immutable?
It's more immutable because it doesn't require social governance.
Yeah, this seems really abstract again. Like you throw out these arguments that just seem really abstract.
If the system on proof of stake requires humans to intervene and there's an attack and it rolls back all that data, what do you think happens to the ordinals sitting on that system? Whereas in Bitcoin, that situation would not
happen. You're aware there have been rollbacks on Bitcoin, right?
Yeah, but the transactions get back in the mempool, and they go right back into the
chain. Okay, and the same thing could happen in a proof-of-stake system. What's the difference?
You can roll back the system requiring social governance
Who do you think controls the miners? Isn't it people that control miners? Isn't that therefore a type of social system?
The algorithm doesn't have any human social governance.
That's now I see where you're coming from. Okay, look, here's the thing. Some people view BTC as being like this autonomous thing. It's like a machine that can't be corrupted by mere human beings, right? And I think that's fundamentally wrong. That's not what Bitcoin is at all. Bitcoin is more like a cyborg. It's part machine. It's part human being. It's human beings being influenced by, incentivized by cryptographic mechanism, cryptographic game theory, right? This is how we can align incentives and create a public good, right? But human beings are still a part of that machine. You can't just take them out of the equation like that. Miners are people too.
That's what I was saying. Proof of work has more cryptographic assumptions, less game theory, and proof of stake is more crypto economic and game theory, less cryptography in the core assumptions.
Okay. It seems like an academic point. Like if proof of stake is more secure and more decentralized,
with the attacks without the liveness or without subjectivity.
Yeah, but again, can you do a counter argument to what I'm saying here? I'm saying the system shouldn't get attacked in the first place.
You can't solve that. Like you're always going to have an attack vector.
That's academic. That's like saying you can't solve for me generating a random wallet and uncovering the Coinbase wallet. Like that could happen, right? There's a tiny, tiny probability of that happening, but we accept it. Right, that's the foundation for all of what we do in cryptocurrencies. There's still academics out there who say the Byzantine generals problems have never been solved. But we don't really care about those academics now, do we?
You can't actually solve it, and there's a real possibility that things will happen.
You're one of those guys?
No, I'm just saying institutions aren't going to bet on the fact that your system can never be broken at some point.
Do you think the Byzantine general problem has been solved?
No.
Okay. I see.
It's the trade-offs have been shifted to, you know, account for these behaviors.
So for me, it's different. For me, like, and just for the audience, in case anyone doesn't know what the Byzantine's general problem is, it is the key problem that the Bitcoin white paper solved, that Bitcoin solved in its first implementation, that you can't double spend. The original story is of two generals trying to coordinate an attack. Like, how do you get them to attack at the same time when it takes time for the messages to go across? That's the Byzantines general problem. You can imagine two Byzantines general or two opposite sides of a siege, which is a colorful one. So interesting, yes. Interesting. Okay, so but see, so for me, that's a position that's overly academic, right? You're saying no, it hasn't been solved, and I'm like, well, Bitcoin is proof that's been solved. Ethereum is proof that it's been solved. Solana's proof that it's been solved. I mean, what more proof do you need? I mean, within a certain probability, right? Sorry.
I mean, that's where the longest chain rule in Bitcoin comes, because there's always disputes. So if someone has a different dispute, then the longest chain rule resolves that. And you don't need any sort of human in there to decide that, okay, this chain is heavier than the other chain. That's what proof of stake has, a subjectivity aspect that needs continuous checkpointing. And if it does have a breach of that, then you need humans to step in and decide, okay, this was a real threat. Everyone agrees. Let's slash this guy, or let's get rid of his nodes, and we'll.
Again, you bring it back to slashing. I didn't have slashing as part of my.
So I'm talking about out of bounds slashing. I'm not talking about in protocol. I'm talking about out of bounds. People decide, let's kick this out. Let's kick this guy out of the system.
Out of bounds slashing could literally occur on a proof of work system as well. So that's, again, not an argument, right?
I'm saying that there is. And the protocol defines no human intervention. That's the benefit. That's why it's...
Okay. Hold on. Are you going to say out of bounds slashing? By the way, what's being referred to here, also for the audience and Hotep, that just means that the community decides collectively that, or maybe the leadership decides, if you will, to destroy someone's coins, to destroy someone's stake. That's obviously a massive betrayal of the social contract and anything that cryptocurrency stands for, right? And you're saying that can happen with proof of stake, but it can't happen with proof of work. That's what you're saying.
I'm saying it's a required aspect of proof of stake, and it's not required for proof of work.
It's a required aspect of proof of stake.
You can go to GitHub and update the code base, and people still have the choice.
How can you say that?
I mean, I've been saying it the whole time. The proof
consensus,
of stake requires.
I mean, that requires consensus to do something like that, right? Mm-hmm.
No, at proof of stake, the deeper you get into it, the more you realize that you need human social intervention to deal with attacks, any sort of large-scale attack that gets...
So you're saying the Ethereum developers could just decide overnight to steal someone's coins or destroy
someone's coins? No. Not the developers. I'm not saying update the GitHubs. Okay. I'm saying...
How would you do it?
Like you were saying, if the small chance that an attack happens, right, like the 51 or 60%, however many billions of dollars it takes, you've captured that system, it requires a restart. That requires humans to decide what steps should we take next. And we've gone down that path when humans have that power.
Okay, how do you restart a proof of work blockchain? That also requires humans. Humans, and like you're looking at miners as if they're not humans. You're looking at node operators as if they're not humans. You're talking about developers writing code as if they're not humans. This is all still humans. And proof of stake is full of humans too. These are just different technologies. This proof of work is not magic. It's not magic.
But the system runs using cryptographic assumptions. It's not humans deciding who should be in this and who shouldn't be. It's completely permissionless, and that's required for decentralization. If you have any sort of permissioning, then you're
So when the inflation bug happened, who decided to fix that?
Well, it was an obvious bug, and it was fixed. That same as Solana going down, and they fixed it.
Yeah. So just a bit of a history lesson for the audience. I'm aware the audience must not know a lot of this stuff, right? So there was an inflation bug in BTC, and was it 6 billion BTC that was created? I don't remember the exact
number. It was an overflow of some number, and they patched it and fixed it. This was before anyone really even knew about it.
It was very early on in the history. Basically, there was a bug which printed, some miner was able to print billions of Bitcoins. And then developers and the pools are like, oh, no. And then they basically push out a patch to fix the Stack Overflow problem. And then they roll back the blockchain, right? Mm-hmm. There's never been a rollback in Ethereum. There's never, ever been a rollback in Ethereum. And there hasn't proof of work. I mean, we want to ground this with real realities, right?
Ethereum had a pretty big issue recently when they switched over. They had a finality bug in their system as well. So they did have a pretty large scale disruption, but I chalk that up to something that's new that's created. But
it's not a rollback, though.
It may or may not have rolled back. I don't know what they did to resolve the situation.
As far as I'm aware, there's never been a rollback. But...
Well, they have an algorithm that disincentivizes rollbacks, but it doesn't mean that there's no rollback. They just penalize nodes for putting something that's already out there, like to go back. They just penalize them, but it doesn't stop.
I mean, like with a rollback, I mean, there's a major mistake in the chain, and in some sort of centralized way, right, you roll back the blockchain in order to
proof of stake. It might be, but you can have rollbacks within the finality period. It's perfectly acceptable.
No, I'm not talking about orphaning blocks or anything like that, right? Mm-hmm. I'm talking about like an actual rollback where like canonical history is rewritten, say, I don't know, 50 blocks in or something like that.
Well, if you have finality, then the idea is that you can't roll back from there. So the challenge is then on the finality. And on Bitcoin, the most you'd see is probably 3 or 4 blocks right now, because most of the miners are connected to each other. And
but hold on. Okay, back to your claim, because I want to call you out on this one. Because you were saying that basically on a proof of stake system, you can steal people's coins and destroy them, and on a proof of work system, you can't. I think that's a very – and we talked about security, and I got you to concede that security is higher. So security is higher. That's harder to attack.
So get to that fault. So to get to the fault, it costs more billions of dollars to do it on something like ETH, right?
Yeah.
You agreed. And that's why I was saying there's more security for short-term.
And there's more people you need to actually convince to make that change on the network. So how can you make that claim?
Not sure, but more people needed to convince. I mean, you could privately accumulate wealth, or you could have been a whale like Lubin or something, potentially having that number of coins and deciding.
No one has
51. Or his coins.
No single entity has 51% in Ethereum today. That's just
not 51%.
Conspiracy theory.
But it's actually it's around 30% to attack the finality of the system of Ethereum. And that's an example.
The Ethereum pre-mine was less than 10% of the total supply. So no one has anywhere near 30% from that. And most of that is sold in the market.
Let's say someone has 30%, or someone is able to buy up 30%, or manipulate the market so they have 30%. And only from there on, it only costs $50 to definitely delay the finality, and only $5 to selfish mine ETH. You know, basically you've delayed the finality and you could roll back blocks as much as only $5. That's a white paper that's written from Harvard University. And if you could delay finality, then the bandwidth costs start to add up on every full node. You know, they have the data availability aspect, and there's a lot of data being put in every second, and that cannot be pruned until you have finality. So if they can push finality off, then the bandwidth cost of every full node goes up, and they
start to get picked up. And how does this lead to deleting innocent people's coins?
Well, I'm saying at some point when this is just one simple attack that maybe could resolve itself, maybe it can't. But at some point, humans need to say, okay, this situation is not acceptable. We're going to kick this guy off. He's going to lose billions of dollars because we're going to kick him off, and we're going to restart the network and slap on the wrist.
You're again going back to these extreme scenarios, and I've already said I bite the bullet. Like, I don't – like, if a network comes under attack, censorship, 51% attack, I mean, maybe you're preparing yourself for that in Bitcoin's case in 10 years, but I don't find that acceptable. And it hasn't happened, like, at a large scale in our industry. That proves that, like, for these large networks, we have sufficient security. Okay? These things work. They function. And if they work and they function, these scenarios don't happen. So, like, all of this just seems – it seems irrelevant. It seems to the proof of work versus proof of stake debate. Completely irrelevant to that.
What I care about is
how difficult is it to attack that blockchain, or like how decentralized is that blockchain? And like if that blockchain is more difficult to attack, it's more decentralized, it's more secure, the proof of stake system is all those things, then I think that's a better system. Even if, and I'll bite the bullet on it, I'm not sure if it's true or not, but I'll just bite the bullet for the sake of argument, even if the proof of stake system deals less graciously with an attack than a proof of work system. Because
I think
at
you
that
have
point,
to start there.
But at that point, I don't care anymore. It's a write-off for me. I think that system has failed. If the security drops that low and the systems are that broken, I don't care. Like, and I honestly don't think Bitcoin dominance will survive such an event. I think that's game over.
Jack,
I mean,
you had a question before?
It's not going to die. Sorry.
Now, previously, it sounded like Jack wanted to ask you a question.
I was saying, what happens if half the internet shuts down for a short period of time, and now the validators are not online or they're slashed. Isn't that situation sort of
it's becoming a bit you keep doing this, you keep bringing slashing into it. I'm not
okay. So let's say not even
as part of my argument. Right?
Sure, no slashing, sir. Okay, proof of stake assumes liveness, right? So it assumes that network is live. If a large percentage of them aren't there, then you end up having.
Answer your question, if 0.5% of the network falls off the face of the earth, then the network continues, just as a proof of work network continues as well.
Can't you rewrite history at will if
no, because now you have a new majority of stake, right? That's how the system works. If a bunch falls off the network, then it just, you know,
but
now you have
required maybe 20% of the network at that point. I mean, your security budget drops.
But the same is true for a proof of work system.
It's not true. The proof of work will continue on at the same difficulty rate.
Hold on. Okay. Barring BTC's slow difficulty adjustments, which is just complicating things. But look, if half of the world was just obliterated by a fun fact, this is a low probability event, but a solar flare, half of the world just gets thrown back into the Stone Age because of a massive, unprecedentedly large solar flare. All the equipment on half of the planet is fried and the rest of the planet is fine because, you know, the planet itself is a pretty good shield against electromagnetic radiation.
We don't even a solar flare, just Amazon goes down. ETH is on Amazon.
let's stick with the solar flare because I like extreme examples. Okay, let's go with that. Right. Okay. Proof of work would continue, and from the
it would just be a little slower, but it would continue.
Yeah, slow. Let's ignore the difficulty adjustment. That just makes it more complicated. But yeah, and that's more a quirk of BTC. That's less an inherent feature of proof of work. Do you know what I mean?
If you're doing proof of work, you have to have diff adjustment. That's just how it works.
No, I agree with you, but just the difficulty adjustments in Bitcoin are so slow.
They
could have made
it
a bit faster.
Yeah, we don't need to deal with it, but yeah, sure.
Yeah. Okay, so basically, the miners just continue, and from the miners' perspective on the other planet of the Earth, they're like, well, very tragic about those miners that died, but hey, we make twice as much money now because with this same amount of – oh, actually, no, because there'll be less fees, right? Nonetheless, it depends what happens with markets in this scenario.
Well, if you have block subsidy, then you still get that, but otherwise.
Yeah, right. So they would actually then get a higher proportion of the block subsidy, or let's just say the block award, generally speaking. They would get a higher proportion and then a kind of self-adjust, basically. Now, let's look at the proof of stake scenario. Half of the planet gets obliterated. The stakers that are present become the new majority. Right. And they make more money because, there's less stakers in total and they're now getting a bunch of the rewards for them. So it's like it's literally the same thing, like the scenario that happens here.
Budget.
And from a practical perspective as well, like you keep bringing it back to these theoreticals. But if it practically keeps running, and if it's practically more secure, and if it's practically more decentralized, that's what matters.
Yeah,
not
but
some
we're not
theoretical
developing these
concept.
Systems for practical. We're developing systems in the adversarial use case environments, not for happy case.
Okay, and even
we're
in
we're not
this
running around with like everything is fine. Like when
yeah, and I'm describing an adversarial environment now, right?
No, you're saying practical. You're saying if everything's practically fine in terms of today.
No, it practically works after half of the globe got annihilated. I think that's pretty freaking awesome.
I mean, it's not hard to develop things.
Can you explain how the network stops functioning in that scenario? Because
well,
I don't think there
your
is
security
a
budget just got a quarter. You know, you just need a small percentage to now go and attack the entire chain.
Same is true for proof of work, and there's a bunch of other variables here, including coin price and et cetera, right? So same
is true. In Bitcoin, the diff rate is still the same. So you actually still have to do the same amount of work.
Yeah, the network would slow down, which is a con for Bitcoin. So proof of stake
is
unaffected, and Bitcoin would actually half its speed, which is fine, honestly, but that's what would happen.
And that's better. It doesn't affect security. It just affects liveness.
Sure. It's irrelevant, though, right?
Yeah. So, I mean, we can move on from that point.
But hold on. But do you agree? Half of the world gets obliterated. Proof of work keeps running. Proof of stake keeps running.
They both keep running, but how susceptible are they in that scenario to someone really coming in and taking advantage? if they were already planning an attack and that happened.
Yeah, and this seems to be a core argument we keep going back to, which is what if it gets attacked? And again, I haven't heard you really respond to my counter argument to that. It's like, it's done. If it's already attacked, it's done. That's a failure. I think it's much better to optimize for the network never coming under attack in the first place. Because I think if it did ever come under such an extensive attack, there's no way it will survive from a societal perspective.
Philosophically, that's where we're differing, because I think that I assume that those situations will happen, especially when we get close to AI agents doing all sorts of things in the cloud. I assume that's going to happen. And I'm hoping that the solutions we come up with will deal with them more graciously than others. And that's my career has been focused on that.
No, I mean, I think that's a very interesting far out scenario. I think ultimately, if you want to protect yourself from Skynet, proof of stake is going to do a better job at it. So it's more secure.
Don't think so. I mean, it can easily infiltrate the cloud.
And for me, it's the same thing, you know, like
it's
money. No, yeah, energy / money. So like the cost to attack a proof of stake system, whether you have to buy stake, whether you have to buy hashing power, is the same thing to me for a dedicated attacker. Right. That's
Bitcoin,
the way I'm looking at it.
Right. They'll be buying Bitcoin and then
pushing the price up in the process.
And
ironic.
Then buying miners and trying to attack. And
why would
they
buy Bitcoin if they're
mine? They need capital to go buy Bitcoin, right?
No, they don't need to buy Bitcoin. They can just use fiat currency to buy mining equipment.
Right. Yeah.
Or to take over mining equipment.
Mm-hmm. Maybe, but I don't. Of course. I imagine a scenario where the fiat probably is not. You can't really. You're in the banking system. AI will be using crypto and not fiat, right?
What is this scenario? Wow. Look. If this is what it takes to defend proof of work, I don't think proof of work has a lot of legs to stand on.
I've made many arguments, and this is just one of them. But
this is the one we're getting to, right? After after this whole conversation.
Well, we have the liveness thing, which is obviously a big benefit of proof of work, but the ability to recover from attacks is another thing.
But again, I don't agree with prioritizing that. Okay, so do you think it's like, because design and blockchain is all about trade-offs, right? I mean, no thing is perfect. We're all making trade-offs here. Is it more important to prioritize for not getting attacked in the first place? Or do you think it's more important to prioritize for how to deal with such an attack happening? And an attack would imply at least several months of full-on censorship and double spending, unprecedented in blockchain history. Right?
So that's an awesome question. And that's why Ethereum is also done. Is try to focus on let's prevent the attack and all other scenarios which are likely to happen we can't account for. We will have human social governance come in and everyone will agree that we need to get rid of this attacker because
no, this is just you're going back to this slashing straw man argument again. I have not made that argument.
Okay.
Well, and it's also irrelevant, completely irrelevant to this discussion.
Okay, so if Solana has a situation with no slashing, then we all agree that Solana just halts and stops and we move on from it, right? And
no, I don't agree with that.
You just said that, that scenario is, if that happens, the system
is
down.
Yeah, if Solana is 51% attacked, right? Someone gains the majority of stake. They carry out double spins. They carry out censorship so that no one can use the network. Then Solana is dead. It's going to crash in market cap over the next few months and it's dead. And any proof of work blockchain that this happens to is dead. And you're arguing for a scenario where this is our utopia. I think that's crazy.
Well, you can't rule these attacks out. And if you're saying that the attacks are happening and those things.
And you
dead,
also can't rule out that I discover the Coinbase wallet just by a random wallet seed, right?
Mm-hmm.
Should Coinbase not have a wallet? Because rule it out.
It's not that level of
But should we just not rely on public cryptography anymore? Like all cryptography is flawed now because I could just randomly generate your key.
Yeah, therefore, is very different. One is 256 and one is
you
who
know
knows
the number?
It could
yeah,
two
good stuff.
It's very different. I think with quantum computing, that is a relevant thing and that's something we're gonna have to fix and have quantum safe signatures in these blockchains, and they're working on that. That's sure, another
but that's again, coming. It's again irrelevant to the debate.
But the probability is much different when you're saying the public key cryptography versus.
Okay, so in that scenario, do you really think that's a scenario blockchain? Do you think Bitcoin can survive that? Let's say in 10 years, security budget drops lower. Just bear with me a few assumptions here. Network comes under attack by, let's say, a state actor who's very determined. Let's say China. Let's say China just forces all of their companies control over the mining equipment. And they're like, Bitcoin's going to do what we want it to do now. And let's say they control 60, 70% of the hash rate. This is the scenario I'll paint, a hypothetical, which is actually not that crazy of a scenario because China is very tyrannical and they did actually in the past have the vast majority of hash rate. So under that scenario, do you really see Bitcoin surviving as like a decentralized public blockchain?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, really? I see Bitcoin as being worth nothing.
So let me just explain a little bit more. Censorship. So no one
Justin,
takes the user.
You got to let him finish.
State.
It's like yeah, you sorry. Ask Apologies. A question and you cut him Apologies. Off. He has a question, you cut him off. You ask a question, right. You cut him off. You don't never let him speak, man.
Thank you for being a good moderator. Go ahead.
It's fine. It's fine. yeah, Bitcoin is worth zero or it's worth infinity. There's no in between. And okay. So if it recovers, it's going back to infinity. If it doesn't recover, and we don't know the answer to that, whether confidence comes back. But it is able to recover by itself. Now, whether humans will have trust in it, that's a different story.
So, well, that's not an argument. The value is infinity. That's completely irrational.
It's hyper Bitcoinization is the path we're taking, and that you know that's the thesis behind.
I think you've just crossed the line. Now it's becoming a religion for you, right? Because now it's a religion. Now it's based on faith, right?
Okay. Well, if fiat goes away, what's replacing it? And how are you going to price everything? Cryptocurrencies. Do you think it'll just be a basket
scalable
of crypto?
Blockchains? Okay. That can offer
so scalable
utility.
Blockchains will work in a basket of goods and they will form money. But which one is the strongest money or which one is the strongest monetary stack? That
I think the strongest money is the one with the best attributes. And I think proof of stake means you have better attributes because it's more decentralized, more secure, more economically sound. Therefore, and more egalitarian, therefore proof of stake systems have a greater potential to create a better money.
Wait a second. One thing I know is fiat. And you said if fiat goes down, people going to use crypto, Justin?
That's what I want.
Oh, that's what you want. Oh,
yeah,
okay,
it's,
okay,
it's
okay.
It's
okay.
More should than would.
Oh, yeah. Okay. All right.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, that scenario where the better parameters of a system, things would, that would be the most valuable. Would things not be priced in that asset from there on, and therefore that ends up kind of keeps rising and compared to everything else? Would that not?
Sorry, can you repeat the question?
In the world where, say, fiat currency goes away, and you think cryptocurrencies would be the bait, that, you know, everyone's using pricing and cryptocurrencies, and you say there's one that has better parameters and it's more secure.
Not well, one per se, but. This trade-off.
Okay, well, a couple based on the philosophy of extra pyramid, it's always one. There's always something. Gresham's law, you're always going to be pushing bad for good, and the good gets driven out.
I would expect like 5 to 10 dominant blockchains in the far future. That's how I would see it playing out.
Okay, there's a couple. What are you going to price the market in? All your basket of goods are going to be priced in. Your productive output is going to be priced in some sort of currency. Some sort of barter instrument and some sort of
value. This is not a particularly large challenge in a digital world, right?
Okay. So, but
you're not going to answer the question, though?
What do you price it in? Whatever is probably the most stable money is probably one of the best things you could price products in. And I would argue that a purely speculative asset is not at all a good example of something that has stable value. I would actually say something that is productive with a lot of utility provides a foundation for stability, which then money can be built upon.
Yeah.
And I think all of this is, and all of this I think is actually possible on the layer one. So if we can scale the layer one, then we have this virtuous cycle of just value and usage all reinforcing each other.
So if that layer one was to take over, would that not have the everything is priced into that because that is what everyone wants and trusts and they want that gas to be able to transact on it.
Therefore, potentially, it ends up in a far
it ends
future,
up being just worth more and more and more over time, right?
Sure. But I mean, if fiat goes away overnight, then I suspect it's going
not
to be
overnight.
Guns and up. Drugs and food that are going to be worth more.
It will be CBDCs, and then people will be able to digitally convert right into crypto pretty easily. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, over time, say over a couple of years, 3-5 years, say it happens, that's why I say I didn't. Infinity, I just mean.
I would say that's closer to 100 years on that timeline for me. But
okay. But anyways, something gets priced in more and more as the base value asset of the world.
And I would say that, and this has been my thesis for many years in terms of how I look at cryptocurrencies as well, is that I think over time, the systems that are able to offer the most utility, are able to offer the most cheapest block space, which can then attract usage, those are the ones that really win because of that virtuous cycle. Look, if you can attract the most usage, then you have the most economic value, you have the most fees, therefore you also become the most secure. Right. Yeah. This is one of the reasons I really was like, okay, Bitcoin is just completely over for me because they're not increasing the capacity of the network. So it's useless. It's pointless. And I felt the same way. So at least I'm consistent when Ethereum abandoned layer one scaling. And I'm like, okay, now this system is pretty much useless and it's going to get completely smashed by the competition. Right. So, and that's what I see happening. And that's kind of a cycle.
But why can't utility be added into Bitcoin without increasing the block limit? Because it's a core.
Well, because you make major trade-offs when it comes to layer two scaling. And I've been a big critic of layer two scaling. There's a whole nother subject. But one major problem, even under the most optimistic scenarios, is fragmentation. Like, you do not have atomic composability between all parts of the ecosystem.
Why can't you build that?
It's a social coordination problem, actually, predominantly. So it's not actually a technological problem. It's getting all of the parties to all agree on using the same standards. You can do that potentially if you enshrine it in the layer one, but that's not what layer two scaling is. Layer two scaling is doing this independent from the layer one. I actually like enshrined rollups. I think they're a great solution, but Ethereum is not seriously pursuing that path anymore.
Yeah. I mean, through ZK aggregation, you can do composable liquidity across rollups pretty easily.
I'm aware there's a bunch of different ways to achieve this. The problem is, for instance, in the case of Ethereum, how do you get Optimism to agree with Arbitrum or Polygon? And they all have their own aggregation lanes, right? Mm-hmm. How do you get one of those large companies, for-profit companies, mind you, to say drop their aggregation layer and start using a competitor's aggregation layer? It doesn't make sense from a kind of free market competitor.
Well, if they were ZK rollups, like, imagine everything becomes ZK. It's pretty easy for someone independently to create a system that creates the aggregation layers.
But again, how do you get everyone to agree to use the same system? It's a major coordination problem. Layer one solves the problem because you don't need to have a external system that you all need to agree to because you've all agreed already to use the layer one. So
if
then it can become seamlessly composable.
If you're sharing the DA, then you're sharing the sequencing. You can
You're right. I agree. If you do shared sequencing, I 100% agree, you will solve the fragmentation problem. What I'm saying is that there's no way in hell the Ethereum core developers are going to get everyone to agree to use their shared sequencing. That's the problem.
Maybe not. I mean, let's look at Polygon, which is a really good example. They created ZK-EVM. So everything is ZK. There's no optimistic assumptions or fraud proofs. And they created something called aggregate layer. And in aggregate layer, you can move your liquidity across any rollup and, you know, trade that. And that's not Ethereum, but that's something that's using the DA and the ordering of Ethereum that's building on top. Right, so, that's just one example of someone that figured it out.
Look, all of the layer twos, like, I mean, I stopped counting after like the top 15, all of them have admin keys that can steal all user funds. All of them have centralized sequences that can censor transactions. Okay. Like, I don't think that's figuring it out. And as it stands today, it's completely fragmented. It's all separate ecosystems and the user experience is total garbage. You know, you're sitting there in a wallet and you have Optimism USDC and you have Arbitrum USDC and you need to bridge between them. It is a total mess, Okay.
Yeah, I think AI is going to fix that. I think UX isn't going to be a problem long term.
No, no. Okay, now you're doing this whole we can abstract it all away thing. And yes, I'm doing a hand wavy motion in that. No, no, you can't. Because if you did that, you would take away critical user choice. So if you're in a perfectly decentralized layer two and you want to interoperate with, say, a permission custodian type layer two, like most of the layer twos now are, then you have to inform the user of that choice. That's an extra step. That's another thing the user needs to know about. So what this ends up becoming, it's not all one big Ethereum ecosystem. It's the optimism ecosystem over here. It's the Arbitrum ecosystem over here. And it's the Ethereum ecosystem over here. These are separate competing ecosystems now. That's what the fragmentation has caused. That's what the perverse incentives are causing to happen. Instead of, scaling the layer one and all of that usage and all of that value all going back to the layer one token and security, especially now that we've figured out how to do sharding,
It won't scale the same way. And the fragmentation is not something that's going to be a hard problem to solve once we, if Ethereum gets close to ossification, you're going to see that sort of problem go away, I think. So.
How? I mean, I've investigated all the possible solutions. How do you solve the social coordination problem? You're just hand waving it away.
What? Why is it social? What part of the social is technical?
Coinbase made over 40 million euros from their sequencer this year, from their layer two, the base layer. Okay. In order for shared sequencing to work, everyone needs to use the shared sequencing. So Coinbase, a for-profit company, would have to give up on that 40 million euros of revenue and any future revenue. They have to convince their board to do that. How likely do you think that is?
I see what you're saying.
Yeah.
So that is a risk on Ethereum.
It's a major risk. I think it's doomed.
So something on Syscoin we're trying to avoid as well is that sort of thing where we have third parties hopefully don't launch. But that's definitely the way we thought about the ecosystem is to build it in a way to show an example that it doesn't have to be enshrined, but show an example of one possible way to solve it by having the shared sequencing set up before the market takes hold and starts using it.
Yes, that could work. You're actually correct about that. And we have examples of that in, say, like Polkadot and things like Atom as well, where they have like IPC and they have these kind of interoperability layers that are kind of enshrined from the beginning. And then you actually really have the potential to solve that problem. There's another problem that you run into.
5 minutes.
I'll quickly. Actually, we should go back to proof of work. I was going to get into Polkadot thing. Let's go back to the debate and put our final thoughts on that one because we just went way off into like
all
the modular scaling debate.
You went all into L2 data availability, ZK rollups. But I love it. It's a lot of education. Let's round this out. Obviously, we're gonna need a part two. let's round this out and give our closing thoughts at this juncture.
Sure. Okay. Do you want to go first?
So I just wanted to end off on the Bitcoin philosophy a little bit. So I think we touched on security budget, and it's really important. A lot of people have this scary thought that the fees are not going to be enough to sustain Bitcoin. I think subsidy is a bootstrapping mechanism in Bitcoin. It's a mechanism that's put in place so that when enough utility exists, when enough resource contention for the block space exists, it should be able to sustain it. Let me run some numbers by you. So yesterday I took a look and there was about $2.2 million of USD in fees that Bitcoin miners earn just on fees, transaction fees. $54 million of Bitcoin per day were mined, right? And we're sitting at 60,000. That's only a factor of 25. Now, it's not a stretch to see a 10x price gain and a 10x resource contention on that. And that becomes a 2.5 times factor. So the factor is not that off and actually make it more scarce. So in my analysis, the fees should be able to cover it, especially when you're seeing runes, ordinals, inscriptions, layer twos, on-chain rollups, off-chain rollups. This is happening whether you like it or not. There's hundreds of millions of dollars going in. We're seeing the space around us getting crowded and we're in that space. So that's why I know from the inside that there's more and more utility coming in without these huge trade-offs. Like this is permissionless, trust-minimized tech that's being created. And the fees are going to be enough to justify once you have the five-year picture play out and the subsidies start to be very minimal. I think the fees will be enough. So I'm just going to end there and say once we're at the gold market cap, we're talking about Bitcoin being at 800K, you know, fees are going to be more than enough. And the, and there'll be DA is going to be more than enough to cover every block is going to be pretty much precious, and everyone's going to want to be ascribing into the data of Bitcoin.
I think well said. And I definitely respect your point of view, and I really enjoyed this conversation as well. You're obviously a very smart and knowledgeable guy when it comes to this subject. So I entirely disagree with you, but I do it with all good respect. Now, I think there's a lot of wishful thinking. And I think any system that requires, you know, as long as the price goes up, the security will be fine. I'm not comfortable with that assumption really at all. I think that's really not what we want to base the future of money on. I think that's incredibly volatile. I think that's even irresponsible, even, especially now that we have much better ways of doing things. I think, combining, say, a small tail inflation with a fee burn allows you to create a economic design that is both secure during the bad times and even more scarce during the good times. I think that's really the best of both worlds, and it's what I prefer. But it's somewhat touches on our discussion, but it's also at the same time somewhat irrelevant to bring it back to proof of work and proof of stake, because to really evaluate these things, we do need to do it independent of the networks that exist today, and hypothesize a little bit on it as well. But like, even with that, it's clear that as of today, and I'm not some like Ethereum fanboy, right? I'm an outspoken Ethereum critic, right? But today, Ethereum has literally more economic security. It has and this is a consequence of proof of stake, direct consequence. It also has far more individual participants. It has a far wider distribution of power in terms of who is involved in the consensus mechanism and participants in consensus. I would therefore say that that makes it more decentralized. And there's many other factors to look at: client diversification, development culture, node distributions. You can do chain analysis. You can look at a whole bunch of different vectors. But I think this is a very important vector. And you have already conceded that proof of stake is more secure, at least in the short term, at least in terms of an attack. And I'm happy to concede in terms of what deals with that more graciously. But I think we've already lost at that stage. I think that's, for me, that's when I lose belief in a system where I'm like, okay, if censorship can occur, then that's just one step too far in terms of what I can accept within a system. And therefore, I want to prioritize for security, for decentralization. And I think, and purely from like really trying to be an unbiased point of view, proof of stake systems, they're just more efficient. Just with the same amount of money, with the same amount of capital, you can get tenfold the security, or you can get lower fees, or you can, you know, I mean, it just seems like a better system. And everything else we say about Bitcoin, which I all mostly agree with, that's the tragedy about this situation. I agree with all of the wonderful things people say about Bitcoin in principle. I just don't think it applies to BTC. And I think the alternatives are just far more capable to actually achieve that over the long term. And I think utility will really drive that home. And in that regard, I actually really admire, I might not agree with you, but I admire at what you're trying to do for Bitcoin. It's one of the best attempts I've actually seen at, you know, doing something like that, like doing real roll-ups for Bitcoin. I mean, that's super cool. That's like, when people talk Lightning, it's like 2017 called, they want their layer two solutions back. Like, come on, let's do ZK rollups. That's totally where it is. I mean, I agree. That's a better way to do layer twos. I mean, layer twos itself are a different discussion. So yeah, so that's where I land on it. Ultimately, I think that when it comes to Satoshi's vision, when it comes to like, you know, what Bitcoin set out to achieve, what the Cypherpunk manifesto talked about in terms of what brings about more freedom in the world. Yeah, I think proof of stake does it better. I really do. I think from an economic perspective, from a security perspective, and from a governance perspective, and from an egalitarian perspective, I don't see what's left anymore after that, besides these very academic points, which again, I find maybe I'm too practical. Maybe you're right. Maybe I should think more about these adversarial scenarios. And there's a balance to be struck there. So
no, I definitely, I've never even thought about the situation that you've elucidated, that if the system breaks, the experiment is over in terms of even a short-term break. So, you know,
yeah.
I'm glad we got to talk, and, you know, that changes my perspective on things, because I didn't know people thought that way. I thought most people designing these systems or talking about these systems and researching them assumed the adversarial conditions and how they can recover from them, and not that they would just walk away from such a system. But, you know, from a perspective of a VC and a perspective of someone on the money market, that makes a lot of sense. So, you know, I appreciate the candid conversation.
Just for the record, I'm not a VC, so I come in more as a blockchain researcher in this discussion. Okay. And nice. And well, okay. I do long-term investment based on fundamentals, so that's why I align nicely, and I get along more with the researcher types than the VC types, let's say. Yeah.
Well, Hotep, thanks for putting this together. I knew it would be really high quality and high value, and I look forward to, you know, working with you, Justin, further, and you know, sharing thoughts. And it's always good to connect to people that have really been in the space for a while and did their, you know, research.
Yeah, thank you. I really enjoyed this as well, and thank you, Hotep, for really putting this together as well.
Oh, thank you, guys.
These discussions.
Oh man, I got the grift off of y'all today. All I had to do was sit back and listen. You guys did all the heavy lifting, so I appreciate y'all. You know what was most fascinating to me about today's conversation was understanding how deep this thing goes, right? Like you know. Individual like myself, I understand marketing, I understand fiat, and it's just like, that's probably got a depth of about 50 feet. Then we get into blockchain, it's got a depth of like 1,000,000 feet. It's like so many terms. I'm like, it's not even as many terms in marketing. Like, what the heck is going on?
That's my fault.
But I love that, because it just shows, you know, how knowledgeable you guys are and how much there is to learn. It's a huge, huge challenge. Ladies and gentlemen, you know, for some of you who these terms are going over your head, break them down. You know, start with one term and learn that one term inside out. Spend maybe a day, a week on it, whatever it is. Then move on to the next one. Don't feel like you got to know all of this. You're never going to catch up to Jag. It's just not going to happen. You're never going to catch up to Justin. It's just not going to happen. But at least spend time to understand what they're saying and being able to take it in. Phenomenal conversation. Really enjoyed this. Thank you for being a part of this. Everyone, make sure you hit the like and the subscribe button. If you enjoyed this conversation, comment, and give some feedback to me and as well. And, you know, cause I want to continue the crypto debates and what you want to see more of, how this should be conducted. You know, should I have questions, you know, et cetera, et cetera. But thank you to the audience, for watching. It's been a very special episode of the Griff Report, and I will see everyone on Monday at 2 p.m. Until then, be well, stay merry, tell somebody in your family that you love them, and as always, thank you, Jag and Justin. Their links in the description box below. Hotep and Bill.